Welcome to The Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Today, our show features Don DeLillo in his first ever appearance in Portland on November 17, 2016. This is remarkable since DeLillo has been publishing since 1971, and we at Literary Arts have been inviting him since 1989. For most of his career, DeLillo has stayed out of the public eye by avoiding readings and other events where he might be asked to talk about his work. In fact, he used to carry a card in his pocket that said, "I don't want to talk about it." So 27 years later, we can say that persistence pays off. DeLillo has written some of the most celebrated and influential books of the last 50 years, including the National Book Award winning White Noise, also Libra, and the 1997 masterpiece Underworld. Robert McCrum in The Guardian wrote, "The truth is that DeLillo is wired into contemporary America from the ground up, spookily attuned to the weird vibrations of popular culture and the buzz of everyday, ordinary conversations on the bus or subway." In this episode, DeLillo is in conversation with Noah Hawley. Hawley is a novelist, having written 5 books, including the bestseller Before the Fall, as well as a screenwriter and producer, and at the time of this event, was adapting DeLillo's most recent novel, Zero K, for the screen. Here's Hawley and DeLillo.
Thank you very much for that welcome. I just want to set your expectations. We're not going to solve all the problems of the world tonight. We're going to talk for about 50 minutes. So I guess the story that I heard was that in the 1970s you had a business card that said, "I don't want to talk about it." So my first question is, do you want to talk about it tonight, and are you here under duress?
I'm ready to go.
You're ready to go. Okay, good.
I meant I'm ready to go.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, everybody. It's been. I don't want to start too big, but let's talk. I sort of feel like talking about endings.
Okay.
Because endings with novels are the hardest part, I find. And so I guess, you know, you and I have talked in the past about how novels often start for you with an image.
Yes.
But how do they end for you? How do you know it's over?
Well, the current novel, Zero K, had no ending for a while. I knew I needed something, and I wasn't quite sure what. And what happened was a memory from many decades ago, probably in the 1960s, came back to me, a personal memory. I was on a bus going west to east in Manhattan. And suddenly the light changed, and I could feel it or see it on my hands. A reddish light, almost golden. What I didn't know at the time was that this is a phenomenon, a natural phenomenon that happens in Manhattan, perhaps twice a year, usually in July, I think, in which the sun sets between the Manhattan high-rises over New Jersey, and it seems to be sitting just over the Hudson River for a brief amount of time, and the light is extraordinary. And this is what was happening on that bus. And the second thing that made me aware of it, aside from the light itself, was that a boy with his father, I believe, or his mother, seated at the rear of the bus, there were only about 5 people on the bus, he started howling at the light. He was looking out the rear window, shouting at the light. But I went closer and realized, to look myself out the rear window, and I realized that this kid of perhaps 11 years old, I'm not sure, had an oversized head and was probably suffering from a certain difficult condition. And I suspected that he was not able to form words, and that his howls at the light were a form of exultation. This is what I suspected. All these years later, this became the end of my novel. I thought back on this, and I somehow it made a certain amount of sense, at least to me. But in fact, it didn't really have to make all that much sense. It was simply there, and I wrote it. It's just two pages or less. I wrote it as I remembered it. And is the memory genuine, a memory from that far back? In this case, I'm nearly certain that it is.
Right, yeah. No, the last two books that I wrote both ended unexpectedly for me, where I went to write that morning not knowing that was the end of the book, but finding myself in the middle of a scene that felt like the perfect place to end. Because, of course, nothing ever ends. You just have to choose a point.
Yeah, and with a novel, it's what you feel that's so very important. And maybe the beginning and end of a novel are the places where the writer's feeling becomes paramount.
Yeah. And so I said to you earlier there were a couple of books that I did want to talk about and specifically, but I guess since we did endings and we're good with endings, let's talk about beginnings and the idea that how do you know, because a novel is not, there's no rule book, so how do you know all the things that go into a book to create it? Because a book like, Mao Tu, which mixes so many different ideas and characters, or White Noise, which has so many different ideas moving into it, how does that all come together for you?
Well, for me, it's intuition. very little advanced planning, no outline, and I go sentence by sentence, word by word, sentence by sentence, and the sentences seem to extend themselves into paragraphs. It's hard to explain. For me, there is an element of a certain mystery. The language itself is what matters most to me, and then people evolve out of this. People evolve out of words and out of images in my mind. I don't. I tend to think when I'm writing in three dimensions. By that I mean I visualize a character in a certain place, in a room or on a street or in a subway. I see an image. The character, even if he or she is the main character, is not all that clear in my mind. I don't really see facial features. I see a figure, but always, almost always, in a place. I don't know if this happens with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is that sense of place, and the finite. But it's interesting, though, because I think, when you talk about that, an image, it's such a strong and literal thing, and yet there's also something in your work that sort of is beyond a concrete the moment, there's a sense that we're the atmosphere around the image and the language itself, and I guess that's a voice, right? That was that always for you how you wrote, or was there an evolution? Do you feel?
It's hard to know what other people see in one's work. It's difficult even to know what I see at times. I began to see shapes of letters on a page at a certain point. I was living in Athens at the time, and I became aware, this is 1979, 80, thereabouts, I became aware, I'd visit ancient temples and look at the writing, the letters, the shapes of old Greek alphabet on marble, and the shapes of the letters seemed so significant, an art in itself, aside from the marble. It changed the way I think about writing. It changed the way I see the words on the page emerging from the old typewriter, the old manual typewriter that I use. Shapes that sometimes match within a word, a letter at the first letter in the word and the sixth letter in the long word. There's a match of shapes in a curious way, very hard to explain, but it's there, and I began seeing it, and I began paying more attention to the language itself, the sentences themselves, the words. And my writing changed from that point on, and it was a sort of private revolution.
Yeah. Do you feel that you write for yourself, or do you feel like you write for an audience? Or
I don't have a sense of an audience.
Right.
I write for the sentence itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Earlier, you told me that Mao Tu started with a phone call. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Mao Tu was published in the early 1990s. It was a tough book to do. I remember very little of it. One reason the subject of Mao Tu has come up is that at the museum, the art museum here, there's a Warhol exhibit. And Andy Warhol did a drawing back in the 70s, perhaps, of Mao Zedong. It was called Mao Tu. And I borrowed that title for my novel. What was the question?
How it started, a phone call.
I got a phone call from a friend, and he said, look at the front page of today's Post, that's the New York Post, the tabloid. So I went out and bought a Post, and there was a picture of the very reclusive writer, J.D. Salinger. Someone had found him in his New Hampshire, or I've forgotten, New Hampshire or Vermont home, and spotted him in town shopping and took his picture for the Post. And this was, and there was Salinger trying to evade the photograph, you know, physically with his arm up. And I thought about this, and it led me somewhat circuitously into the novel Mao Tu. The main character is a reclusive writer, hiding from whoever might want to talk to him, interview him, photograph him. During the course of the novel, he changes in a number of ways, but that's what got me started, just that picture.
And yet the book itself doesn't start there. It starts in Yankee Stadium, much like Underworld started in a stadium, with another character who obviously plays a big role in the book. But how did that... I mean, you've said that Pofko at the Wall started as a story that just didn't stop, but do you remember the instinct to start with the mass wedding in Yankee Stadium?
There was a man, do you remember the name of the group?
Oh, the Moonies, right? Wasn't it?
Yeah. Sun Myung Moon led a group who were referred to irreverently as Moonies, and they would have mass weddings of young people who didn't know each other until the wedding. This is what they did. And they had an event in New York at Madison Square Garden. I decided to move it in my novel to Yankee Stadium. And so there's a great event of thousands of people being married. And then the novel follows one of them, along with other people, of course. That's how it began to develop.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard of this group in many years. I think they felt they weren't welcome in this country.
Perhaps, or he was busted on tax fraud, or something like that. And yet, Zero K feels like a much more contained book, in that it's more focused on a specific place and specific characters.
Yeah. And it's shorter. It's only about 285 pages, but it took 3.5 years to write. And you know, this doesn't disturb me as long as I kept going. There were a number of interruptions. But I have no memory of writing this book. I can't think of, and particularly since I didn't go anywhere to do research of any kind. And so there's no physical sense of where I might have been to explain a particular chapter or a particular passage. It's all the writer stooped over his typewriter at the desk. And why did it take so long? I have no explanation at all. Do you know?
A lot of good restaurants in New York, too.
A lot of good restaurants in New York.
Yeah. I was interested because there is a similarity on some level between Zero K and the book Ratner's Star, in that they both sort of take you to these very science-driven hideouts, and yet they're very different books, both in scope and in voice. And I don't. Do you recognize the guy who wrote the first book? Is the book just...
No, that's a good question, because I don't think I do recognize the guy who wrote Ratner's Star. It's a sort of formalized structure. The structure of the book is everything. I won't try to describe it in detail, but largely because I don't remember. But you know what I remember? I remember that the letters in the word Ratner's, four of those letters are the same as the four letters in the word star. It's that kind of novel. It's that curious symmetry. And it took quite a while to write. It was quite a challenge. And after I finished, I wrote a very different kind of books.
Right. Do you feel like there was a sense with that book that as a novelist you were trying to do something with the novel that was a more intellectual process?
It was a more structural process.
Right.
This was everything. And the main character is a 14-year-old, I think he's 14, mathematical genius. I think young people can excel in only one, maybe two or two disciplines, music and mathematics, and perhaps one other that I've forgotten. And so it was not an exaggeration to have a mathematical genius at age 14. My problem was that I was not a literary genius at age whatever I was to make this novel work as I hoped it would work.
One of the things that struck me when I read it, and with a lot of your work, is the New Yorkness of it. This was not just a 14-year-old prodigy. He was a 14-year-old prodigy from New York, and there was a certain tone of voice that he had.
Just a kid from the Bronx.
Yeah.
Like me.
Just like in Underworld,
yeah.
This man that we meet who lives in Arizona and recycles and imitates Italian movie gangsters to the delight of his friends, once upon a time was a real kid in the Bronx.
Well, I started out writing short stories set in the Bronx, in the Italian Bronx, because that's all I knew, essentially. And then I discovered the world once I began living in Manhattan and elsewhere.
They come to
that's,
us.
That's a pretty, yeah. It's a pretty strong statement, isn't it? That I might have to apologize for. Anyway. That's what happened. Where were we?
We were talking about New York as a voice and whether that, because that there's a nice tension for me in that very, the street language and the more formal
see,
language.
See, I went back to the Italian Bronx for yeah. Underworld after not having written about it for decades. And I found great pleasure in it. I revisited the old neighborhood. And writing about it made me consider myself the world's ranking expert on these two or three streets and how people spoke and what they looked like and the slang language that we spoke then, a sort of Bronx English Italian, a very, very curious language. I had a great deal of trouble spelling the words, but there was no expert to contradict what I was saying. I was the expert. And anyway, that you know, this is one of the rare times when one feels an almost visceral pleasure in writing. And it was based very largely on the strength of memory, personal memory.
When we spoke before, you know, I told you that I had been in preparation for these interviews. We've done two now. The Harry Ransom Center in Austin, you donated all your papers, probably just to get stuff out of your house. But
partly.
Yeah. So I've gone, if you wondered who was going to look at that stuff, it was me. But you know, this fascinating pleasure of the novel is to go look at the through the process, almost as if picking through the brain. I apologize. But you know, what was interesting to me is in that first notebook for Underworld, not only did you have the shot heard around the world, the baseball game, and the Russian nuclear test, the headline on the New York Times, but literally on that first or second page of the notebook was also Truman Capote and the black and white ball. And there was a sense, almost as if all the elements of the novel had come, you know, in a series of thoughts and in a very short period. I don't know if you remember that or not, but you had also talked, I think, about with Zero K, how the first line of that book was there in the earliest notebooks as well.
Yeah, it surprised me when I looked through my notebooks for the current novel. The first sentence is, "Everybody wants to own the end of the world." And I had no idea that I'd scribbled this into a little notebook that I wrote random thoughts in. There it was. And then it came back to me when I actually started writing the novel. Many curious things happen. And what I wanted to ask you concern the work you're doing now, right?
Yeah.
Now, how many different kinds of work? Because you've worked in, I'll let you tell us.
Yeah, I mean, I started as a novelist, and then I started doing some feature film work, and then my motto is, what else can I get away with? So, I've had some luck in television as well. There's a luxury to having an idea and saying, well, what medium is this? You know, because...
That's what I want to ask. Yeah. How do you know what it is?
Well, it's interesting, I think, because for something to be a novel, which I think you have to live with for years and years, there has to be enough there. It can't just be a story of this happened, then this happened. It has to be about a lot of things that are interesting. I mean, you've talked about how a book will start with an image for you, but often for me it starts with a question. You know, something I don't understand about the world or people, and then it goes from there. And you know, I like to nerd out on theme, and you know, even for Fargo, there's a lot of reading and research, and I just in Texas, I asked a few UT professors to get together and kind of have a round table. Oh, really? Since what I really should do is spend 5 years reading books and thinking about things, but I don't have that kind of time, so I thought I would just talk to some very smart people and see what came out of it. But you know, there is a sense with a show that it has to have a certain beginning, middle, and end, but there's a length to it that's different, and obviously a feature film is a two-hour thing that is a much more plot-driven thing. So it just depends.
So your TV series would take, say there were 8 episodes.
Right.
How long would it take to write? I mean, do you have to finish all 8?
Yeah.
Before they start shooting?
Well, it's nice. I mean, usually the way TV has worked historically was that, you know, they, back in the ancient days, you would make 22 or 24 hours of a show, and so you had to have a writer's room because no one could write that much because you're filming while you're writing, so to do all those jobs at the same time is just literally impossible. With Fargo, because I had written one script, and because they picked it up in November, and it's a winter show, there was no way to possibly film it until the following winter, and I said, okay, well, so I'll write all of them, but, you know, give me 4 writers in a room for 12 weeks and we'll just sort of break the whole story, and, you know, because it's an odd thing to write a movie called Fargo, which at the very beginning it says this is a true story, but it's not a true story at all. There's an element of randomness and truthiness that it has to have.
Where were you working when they were shooting?
So the first year I was up in Calgary where we film. Canada is America's Hollywood. I mean, you know, it's where everything gets filmed. So I was up there. First year was 25 below or 40 below or something crazy like that. And then, you know, you're writing and you're editing at the same time. And so, you know, there was some L.A. and all that. I live on a lot of planes. But the point is, I tried to separate writing from production, because if you know how a story ends, you can lay in all the visual elements that you need, which, you know, I mean, I think there is that novelistic tool as well, where you write stuff that you don't know how, why it's in there, and then suddenly, months later, you have the eureka moment of how you're going to pay it off.
Speaking about months later or years later, I realize that it's going to be, next week will mark the 53rd anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. I'm always aware of this. It's November 22nd.
Yeah.
Because I spent some years working on the novel Libra, and the curious thing that comes to mind is that when I worked on my first novel, which was published in 1971. I remember how it ends with the narrator, a fellow named David Bell, driving his rented car through Dallas, intending to return it to the airport and then get on a flight to New York. And in this final paragraph of the novel, I mention certain landmarks which the character recognizes as significant. He drives along Main Street, makes a left turn onto Elm Street, past the Texas School Book Depository, past the grassy knoll and the stockade fence, under the triple overpass, along Stemmons Freeway, past Parkland Hospital and out to Love Field, all these names. And the names had enormous significance for many decades, for quite a few years, many decades, in fact, these names associated with Dallas and the assassination of the president in 1963. But what I didn't know when I was writing this through a character's sensibilities is that maybe 12 or 13 years later, I would find myself walking past all of these landmarks in Dallas, because I realized that I wanted to write a novel about the assassination of President Kennedy. So everything became three-dimensional to me. There it was, Dallas and Fort Worth, and I went to New Orleans, and I went to Miami. And I spent time in my old neighborhood in the Bronx because I discovered that Lee Harvey Oswald, as a teenager, had lived in the part of the Bronx with his mother when he was 14 years old and I was 16 years old. This was quite a shock, a revelation of a sort. And of course, I went to the neighborhood where he grew up, which was walking distance from my own neighborhood, and began to wonder if I'd ever seen this kid anywhere.
Yeah. And there's something, one of the things that always struck me about that book was the mother's voice.
Mother's voice.
And I wondered at the time how much, because I know she testified to the Warren Commission, and I wondered how much of her language was taken from the research material and how much was sort of invented.
She provided me with quite a bit of material, including the intonation of her voice, the curious language. In the room where I work now, behind me, as I sit at my typewriter, there's a bookcase that goes from one wall to the other. And on the top shelf, there may be 100 books, close to, related to the assassination of the president, books I used as research. And among them are the 20, how many volumes? The 20, damn it. I've forgotten the number, but it's the report of the Warren Commission on the assassination of President Kennedy. And I read maybe half of these. I think there may be 13, I'm not sure. And it's astonishing now when I just happen to notice that top shelf and remember the event itself and the time I spent, and the power of these books, the power of the event translated from, in some cases, our living memories, depending on our age, and the connection between our memories and photographs and the words on the page of all these books, most of which I'd read cover to cover when I was working on the novel. It's something that is always here, and that's why I think of it now.
Yeah, and there's a power to the fact that there was also so much secrecy about it as well. The fact that it was captured on film, but no one was allowed to see that film for what, close to a decade.
Yeah, the Zapruder film.
Yeah, and the reports themselves, and this idea that this thing had happened in front of our eyes, and yet we still didn't know what happened.
Yeah, there were 26 volumes of the Warren Report, and the Zapruder film, coincidentally, runs about 26 seconds. And this man, Abraham Zapruder, was standing on Elm Street with his Bell and Howell camera. And when the motorcade went past, and he filmed the crucial moment, in particular, of the headshot that killed President Kennedy. It's a terrible, awesome sight. But it's history. And for years, it wasn't allowed to be shown anywhere. I don't remember exactly who owned it at the time. I think Zapruder sold it, and then would eventually regain it, and there would eventually be the ability of anyone to buy the 26-second film, which I haven't seen in many years, and which I managed to get before it was available for sale, because somebody told me about an ad in Rolling Stone magazine. Some guy in a garage in Quebec was selling JFK material, including the Zapruder film.
And did you go up there?
No, I
mail
ordered it through the mail.
Yeah. Not the weirdest thing you've ordered through the mail, but but there is this sense that, certainly in that novel, but also in Underworld, and also in White Noise, of individuals and history and this collision, and how, you know, Jack Gladney in White Noise, I mean, the fact that he's a professor of Hitler studies is in no way tangential to what the book is about, or the fact that Underworld, I mean, and you have characters in the Underworld who watch the Kennedy assassination. I mean, they're watching the news like that. That scene came back again for you.
And yes, in Underworld, and these characters in Underworld had a bootleg copy of the Zapruder film. As I said, it was illegal to show for some years. But they had a bootleg copy, and they screened it in somebody's apartment, and crammed with people who wanted to see it, some of whom would then start weeping as they watched the film. And it turns out to have been a sort of conceptual artwork. There were a number of TV sets stacked. Mm-hmm. I've forgotten how many of them exactly. And then different segments of the film would be shown on different screens, creating a kind of overwhelming pattern of grief and sadness. And people sat watching for hours. This is something that came to me late in the novel, and I felt I had to follow it to its conclusion.
And there was obviously in the conception of Underworld that sense of history, the fact that on the front page you would see those two headlines about a baseball game and a Russian nuclear test, but then also in that opening chapter about the game itself, the fact that J. Edgar Hoover is there, that Toot Shore is there, and Jackie Gleason is there, and
Frank Sinatra.
And Frank Sinatra. And you have a Bruegel painting that was in Time magazine. And that sense of all these things, obviously that there's research that's involved in finding those things out. But at what point, when you realize those people are there, do you feel that you can fictionalize them or write those characters, I suppose?
Yeah, research and coincidence. What happened was, I read in the newspaper that it was the 40th anniversary of a famous baseball game that took place in New York in 1951. It was a playoff game between the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Giants, played at the old Polo Grounds in Harlem. And the game had a very dramatic ending. A player named Bobby Thompson hit a game-winning home run off the Dodgers pitcher, Ralph Branca. And these two men then became joined in history and for decades. So it gave me the idea to go to the local library and look at microfilm of the New York Times for October 4, 1951. This was 40 years later. And what I saw on the front page were matching headlines, each three lines long, and with the same number of columns beneath the headlines. And one headline said, Thompson hits game-winning home run, Giants defeat Dodgers. Words to that effect. And on the other side of the page, Russians explode second atomic bomb, etc. And I thought, here is my novel. And it was astonishing. And 5 years later, there was my novel.
And it, yeah, just like that, wrote itself. But at a certain point, you also had to decide that the book would go backwards, that you would start in the 50s and then jump ahead and then work your way back.
I started in the 50s and then I finished what was a prologue. And then I started chapter one the day after the prologue ends, which was in October of 1951. And I wrote for about 3 weeks and realized this was all wrong. I don't know why. It was a moment of inspiration. And I understood that what I had to do was to jump from 1951 to 1990s and work backwards to the 50s again. And that's what made the novel. If I hadn't thought of that, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, in the sense of this character who, all these years later, he jogs, he recycles, he's become American in a very different way. Obviously, as a kid in the Bronx, he was American, but in an older way, in a sort of original way. You know, he was he sounded like where he was from, and lived among other immigrants, and then moved to Arizona, where he became part of a culture that had sort of erased those specifics. And I wonder how much of that was on your mind as well when you were writing it, that sense of assimilation.
He assimilates at his own expense. He goes much too far, and I think he begins to know it. And when he thinks back, I don't have the book in front of me, but He wants to go back to those days of rage, his personal rage, when he was a teenager in the Bronx, and when he committed a serious crime, a manslaughter, accidentally, on a dare, shooting someone to death. This was where he starts, and he ends up in a quiet suburb of Phoenix, thinking back on those raging days of his. And I guess the novel ends around roughly at that point.
Yeah. You know, there is, I Andrew read a quote before we came out about the Americanness of your work. I wonder what that means to you, if anything, or are you just a writer who happens to live in America?
Well, you know, baseball.
Yeah.
We started this novel with baseball, and throughout the novel, the baseball is owned by different people. The novel follows the baseball, and it is finally owned by the main character. This is a kind of America that I follow. I think my more recent novels have been less so than in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s.
Yeah,
they've become a little less devoted to the ambiguous power of this country, the power, the cultural power, the military power, and so on. And I think that's probably true of the current novel as well.
Yeah. Being that it takes place mostly in Kazakhstan. Yeah.
I was going to say Uzbekistan.
Well, you're probably right because you wrote the book. You know, so not to talk about me, but I wrote this book called The Good Father, which was a lot about, it was this doctor.
I don't think we heard the title.
Oh, The Good Father, yes. So a doctor who learned that the son from his first marriage had been accused of shooting a presidential candidate. And the book becomes a lot about, as a doctor who sort of solves these medical mysteries, he has the hubris to think that he can solve this and figure out if his son did it or not. And part of the way he does it is to do these case studies about lone gunmen and to try to hold them up to the light and say, well, here's Jared Loughner, you know, posing in a motel room in red banana slinger undershorts, and is that my son? That doesn't seem like my son, or right. Or Sirhan Sirhan. And,
right.
But, you know, there's...
Remind us who the first guy is.
Jared Loughner. He shot the congresswoman in a parking lot, like a supermarket parking lot, a bunch of people. Right. And there was this sense that I had as I was writing it and looking at all these stories, and obviously Oswald was sort of one of them, although his journey took him to Russia. But the part of what we have is this definition of the American experience is just, this is a country that it's enormous, and you can get lost in it. And you know, in my particular case, for this kid who was 20, you know, who at the moment in his life that he probably needed structure, you know, found himself out on the road and disappearing into this landscape. You know, it's an interesting thing, I think, to live in a country this size and what it does for, for the writers who live here. So I think we're going to take some audience questions. I think there are cards that you guys filled out if you want to ask them over while we're, you know, getting here. And Andrew will... Oh, look what I got. So I'm going to read a couple of these, and we will talk about them. This is from Debbie Burke. She says, much of your work has examined socio-political and cultural turmoil and the effects on people. Stories like yours help us understand our world. What is the story that needs to be told now, and will you tell it? Please. I added the please. I'm talking to you.
No.
um,
The country has been changing. This country has been changing. And of course, it has very recently changed unalterably, many of us think. Will fiction come out of this situation, worthwhile fiction? I have no idea. We assume that there will be many more nonfiction books dealing with the recent election. What about novelists? There must be a number of novelists thinking about this now, and wondering if this is a challenge that they are equal to. Aside from that, I would dodge the question completely.
Good. I think that's. You did start by saying you were ready to go. Is there anything that you have created that you wish would be shared or discussed more widely? Any books or work that you've done that didn't get the attention you thought that they deserved?
No, I've had a lucky life as a writer. I've been very lucky. And I have, you know, believe it or not, I have no complaints. And you know, it started at the beginning. It took me forever to write my first novel. And it took 4 years. After 2 years, I decided that I was a writer. I knew this. And if this book never got published, I would keep on writing fiction. But it did get published. The first publisher who saw it. I didn't even have an agent. I just sent it to a particular editor who'd written me a letter about a short story of mine he'd seen in some magazine. And suddenly, I was a published novelist. And I've continued to be lucky ever since. That's my problem.
Okay, no complaints. I like it. If you were writing White Noise today, what themes from our culture would you want to include?
White Noise was a difficult, well, it wasn't difficult. It took me forever to start working on that novel. It seemed like forever. I'd just come back. I mentioned having lived in Athens, in Greece. I'd just come back. And I seemed to have nothing to write. It was very odd. This had never happened before. And then at a supermarket, a local supermarket, I began to look more carefully at everything. This is because in Athens, there was only one supermarket somewhere at the edge of town. And I'd forgotten what American supermarkets were like. And I discovered a world that I'd totally forgotten, a world of tabloid magazines, the world of bright lights, the world of a voice from nowhere talking about today's sales of different kinds of pasta. And I thought, what are these people telling me? There seemed to be so much vividness in a simple visit to a supermarket, things I'd forgotten or things I hadn't noticed at all that I was now seeing. And I guess this is what a writer is supposed to do. He's supposed to see what we're all seeing, but in a deeper way. And that's how I got started on White Noise.
And there's this nice tension in the book. There's such a fully realized sense of family in that book as well, and the fact that you have this couple who they both have children from past marriages and then children from their marriage now, and the voices of those kids and the voices of all those people, and famously the daughter who he listens to her in her sleep, she's saying Toyota Celica.
And I've forgotten that.
Yeah.
See, it's pure poetry, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you don't know what the words represent.
Right. But the fact that the language, kind of works its way in. And of course now you have kids walking around looking for Pokemon, right? And then, in this theater right now, there's a Pokemon, like, right?
Right.
You know, it's such an odd thing that, and obviously consumerism was a big, not in a political way in the book, but really in a sense of how it's affecting our language and our sense of identity.
Yeah, and there's a character in White Noise who analyzes all this. He's an academic, and he analyzes this in an academic manner. You know, of course, it's meant to be funny, and I hope it is, but I thought that supermarkets were worth studying to a certain degree.
Well, and I think we talked a little bit about Ratner Star, and certainly there was a sense with, can we really do all these questions? There was a sense of the novel for you had, there was something effortless about that book, it felt like. Like all of the, you were firing on all cylinders.
Which novel?
On White Noise, and obviously you got a lot of recognition for that book, was there a sense after that of, I don't have to think as hard about how to do it, I just am going to trust my instincts?
I trusted my instincts on White Noise, absolutely, but I don't think that worked with subsequent novels in quite the same way.
Right.
People have been interested in White Noise. Filmmakers have been interested. And one day it may happen. This is not something that I depend on in any sense. I've always felt that there has been one film, actually two, made from my work. And David Cronenberg made a very impressive film version of Cosmopolis. And what surprised me was that he adhered very closely to the novel itself, his screenplay and the film. I've always thought that if someone made a film of one of my novels and it was totally different from the novel, it would not affect me in any way. I would not be, just, as long as it's a worthwhile film. The book is here, and the film is there. So, what have you experienced?
Well, I think there's a dialogue that has to go on. You know, I was asked with Fargo to adapt the movie Fargo without any of the story or the characters from the movie.
Is that right?
Now, that's an odd thing, right? Because then they're saying, can you make us a Coen Brothers movie, which, of course, no one had ever asked me before.
Right.
But, it did feel like someone shows you a painting of a city and says, can you paint this without any of these buildings? Like, what are you doing? You know, except... Yeah. And so it did force me to look at the movie Fargo and at Joel and Ethan's work in general and say, well, what makes this movie this movie? There's clearly... And when I went in and talked to the network about it, I said, why is it called Fargo? It takes place in Minnesota, right? Except that the word Fargo is so evocative of a place like what Joel and Ethan have called Siberia with family restaurants.
Right.
Is
that in the TV?
No, it's just an interview with them once. No, I don't want to insult Siberia or Minnesota or anything. Now I forgot what I was going to say. But, so it was really, it's a fascinating challenge. And I said, well, so it's called that because it's evocative, but also now the word Fargo comes to represent a kind of story, right? Like a true crime story that isn't true, where truth is stranger than fiction. And,
right.
And so if you think about it that way, then really there's a sort of mind space that these stories inhabit.
Mm-hmm.
If you get literally stuck trying to make everything that happens in the book happen in the film, yeah. I think it's about intent. And obviously books are very language heavy, often very, dialogue heavy, a film is about cinema. It's about images, and so you have to figure out how to take what you did in the novel and do it in a movie and get the same effect, I think.
You're disappointing a lot of people by not reading their questions.
Yeah, no, I'm doing it right now. Oh, now I'm going to choose a good one for you. So someone wants to know if you grew up speaking Italian at home, and how did that shape your writing style and sentence structure?
My parents were born in Italy, and I grew up in a skinny little house in the Bronx that had three generations in it. Grandparents, my parents, my uncle and aunt, my sister, my three male cousins. And so we did hear Italian spoken. However, it was a certain dialect in the part of Italy then known as Abruzzo. It's now part of Molise. I don't know how that happened. But it was a language that sounded sort of Romanian rather than Italian. It was very odd. And, you know, we, the younger generation, learned curse words and that sort of thing, but not a great deal else. Names of food, that sort of thing. It was macaroni. It wasn't pasta. It was macaroni.
Right. Yeah.
Remember that.
I was listening to Terry Gross interviewed Francis Ford Coppola, and he was talking about his relationship with Mario Puzo, and that he had this thing about the character who cooks was saying, you know, making the gravy, you know, you first brown the meat, and Mario wrote, gangsters don't say brown, they say fry, you know, and there is something very specific. Right. There's difference to that, to those words. Yeah.
So, and to answer the question, my Italian is very primitive, and I was in Italy recently. And I discovered that it hasn't improved over the years at all.
Someone has asked, what brought you to your characters in Cosmopolis?
It was the idea of the white stretch limousine, which suddenly appeared on Manhattan streets. I guess in the 1980s, possibly later, I'm not sure. But suddenly, I told, you know, it's the most unlikely place Manhattan is with its grid system, and having these enormous stretch limos trying to turn corners at 45 degrees was comical. And I finally began to notice them in a way I hadn't before. And I began to think about stretched limousines in a place such as Manhattan. I didn't have a character. I had an automobile. And that's how the novel started. Eventually, I placed a young man, of an extremely wealthy young man, in the rear seat of one of these limousines, and I went from there.
It's my own personal theory that no one in New York is actually going any place. They're all just looking for parking. All 24 hours a day. So.
Exactly.
Are you related to the DeLillo pastry shop family on Arthur Avenue?
I once walked into the DeLillo pastry shop, and I said to the young man who was behind the counter, I said, hey, my name is DeLillo. And he said, that was it. No, there's no relationship at all.
No.
And if there had been, I would have broken it off immediately.
Yes. And that's New York in a nutshell. Okay, we have time for a couple more, so let me get you a good one. How can a young person without the natural ability to organize thought in a readable way become a writer?
Well, there was a time when I was that young person.
Well,
you know what it is? You have to write. That's all. You have to write. You can't sit and think about it. You have to write. Reading can be a help, but not in such a direct way. Just sit down and write and begin to believe in yourself. Begin to believe in what you're writing. Of course, you have to be writing something worthwhile in order for that to happen. That's the tough part. But that's my answer, right.
All right. I think we should end it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Don DeLillo in conversation with Noah Hawley at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in 2016. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from The Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast with production help from Paige O'Rourke. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.